Father, we're grateful for our time this morning, and we just thank you for the opportunity we have to look at some of the great figures in Christian history this morning as we continue our look at church history. And thank you for the time we have to gather as your people to worship and to love you and to love one another. We thank you for these things in Christ's name. Amen. So last week, we're in the middle of a series where we're doing church history, and at this point, we're looking at some of the big names and big figures in church history. And last week, we took a look at Charles Haddon Spurgeon and kind of wrapped up, but then, you know, afterwards, I got thinking, man, this Spurgeon is just, like I told you, he's one of my favorite figures in church history. So I'm going to revisit him just a little bit this morning. I need to keep the pace going because I know this series needs to come to a close eventually. So what I thought I would do is just to kind of do a little bit of a encore on Spurgeon. One of the things about Spurgeon that I didn't really get to do last week, I gave you a lot about his history and his beliefs and his background and give you a little bit of the color of a character, showed you pictures and things like that, like we normally do. But the thing about Spurgeon is the things he says are the things that really are just grab you, you know. And I thought we didn't really get to look at that. And it's kind of hard to do with PowerPoint slides. So what I did is I printed some stuff up here, just a couple of my favorite quotes. I'm going to read just a handful of them to you this morning, and then I'm going to hand these out. I don't want to hand them out first because you'll be trying to follow along. I'd rather you just listen. I'm just going to read a couple of them, and then you can take these away. These are among my favorites, and I could probably put together 50 pages, literally. So as we know, Spurgeon was a Calvinistic Baptist at that, and his parents were not. You remember that? So here's a kind of a witty saying of Spurgeon's. After Spurgeon's baptism, his mother wrote him a letter. "Ah, Charles, I often prayed the Lord to make you a Christian, but I never asked that you might become a Baptist." Spurgeon replied, "Ah, mother, the Lord has answered your prayer with his usual bounty and giving you exceedingly abundantly above what you ask or thought." That is classic Spurgeon right there. So, but there's some other quotes. Some are funny, but some are just kind of give you pause for thought, you know. He had a great passion for evangelism and wanted to impress that upon us. And I think I will confess that I don't feel the urgency about evangelism that I need to feel, and I'm sure all of us can say that. Here's something he says to that. "Love your fellow man and cry about them if you cannot bring them to Christ. If you cannot save them, you can weep over them. If you cannot give them a drop of cold water in hell, you can give them your heart's tears while they're still in this body." Very well put. You remember two different time period was Whitfield and Wesley, which we looked at in here, right? And they were famous preachers of the gospel. Spurgeon says, "Whitfield and Wesley might preach the gospel better than I do, but they could not preach a better gospel." Yeah. I thought that was good. He speaks to the idea of contentment with this little story. These are kind of little anecdotes, and he would just work these into his sermons, you know. He said, I heard of some good old woman in a cottage who had nothing but a piece of bread and a little water. Lifting up her hands, she said as a blessing, "What? All this and Christ too?" And then just one last thing. I want to read you the beginning of a sermon. This is out of his book of prayer, which Sandy and I have read through his book of prayer. I just love listening to his prayers. But this was an actual sermon in the end of the book of prayer that he has. I'm just going to read you the opening paragraph, give you kind of a feel. It was a sermon on Jeremiah 33:3, which in the King James, which he used, "Call unto me and I will answer thee and show thee great and mighty things which thou knowest not." So here's what Spurgeon opened up with. "Some of the most learned works in the world smell of the midnight oil. But the most spiritual, the most comforting books and sayings of men usually have a savor about them of prison damp. Huh. I might quote many instances John Bunyan's Pilgrim may suffice instead of 100 others. Remember, that was one of his favorites. And this good text of ours, all moldy and chill with the prison in which Jeremiah lay, hath nevertheless a brightness and beauty about it, which might never have had if it had not come as a cheering word to the prisoner of the Lord, shut up in the court of the prison house. God's people have always, in their worst condition, found out the best of their God. He is good at all times, but he seemeth to be at his best when they are at their worst. Just a lot in that, isn't there? I mean, that really gives you some real food for thought. So just kind of, if you guys just kind of pass these around, and I will move on because we got to cover our next name today. So as I promised you, we are going to cover C.S. Lewis today. C.S. Lewis is a very different character from Spurgeon. Very different. We're looking at a time frame from 1898 to 1963. So he's one of the more modern people that we've covered thus far. Clive Staples Lewis, that's what C.S. stands for, wrote a poem to a young admirer in 1954. Here's what he said. I'm tall, fat, rather bald, red-faced, double chin, black-haired, have a deep voice, and wear glasses for reading. If the famous author had been prone to notice clothing, he might have added his trousers are usually in dire need of pressing, his jacket's threadbare and blemished by snags and food spots, and his shoes scuffed and worn at the heels. And it gives you just kind of a little bit of a colorful picture of C.S. Lewis as a man, as a character. But Jack, as C.S. Lewis's friends knew him, was not bothered by faction. By the way, that's interesting. He was I think those of you who know C.S. Lewis, I know some of you are big fans, some of you maybe not, but he went by Jack. Clive Staple, where do you get Jack out of that, right? So the story is that he had a little dog when he was 4 years old named Jaxie, I think it was. And when his dog died, he was real upset by it. And so he insisted everybody call him Jaxie. And eventually he just shortened it to Jack. He always hated the name Clives. You know, some people are given a name by their parents and they don't like it. And so they try to figure out a way to get around that. So that was his deal. So anyhow, just a little side note there. So while he may not have been a fashion king by any means, he was meticulous about some things, particularly the precise use of words, the quality of evidence presented in arguments, and meter in verse. And it's for his books and ideas the Oxford scholars remembered as one of the great Christian writers of the 20th century. And again, most of us know him in one form or fashion, maybe from his books, maybe from some of his books have been made into movies, even. It's said of C.S. Lewis, he was raised in a library. Well, that sounds interesting. Lewis was born into a bookish family of Protestants in Belfast, Ireland. He was an Irishman. We think of him as English because that's where he spent a lot of his adult life at Oxford, but he was actually Irish. In fact, when he first came to England, I read that he despised the English. He just couldn't stand. He said the sound of their voice sounded to him like demons. That's just funny. And he sought out the company of Irishmen quite often. Anyways, his family were bookish people, eclectic in their reading taste. They purchased and read endless books. There were books in the study, books in the dining room, books in the cloakroom, books too deep in the great bookcase on the landing, books in the bedroom, books piled as high as my shoulder in the cistern attic, books of all kinds, Lewis remembered, and none were off limits to him. So his family was really into books and reading. They had all kinds of books, and they encouraged their kids, have at it, kids, read. And so on rainy days, and there were, as you can imagine, many of those in Ireland, you know, the kind of climate we have in Ireland, he pulled volumes off the shelves and entered into the worlds created by authors such as Conan Doyle, Nesbitt, Mark Twain, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. He had a brother named Warren, and it was only after Warren was sent off to English boarding school in 1905 that Jack became somewhat reclusive as he spent more time in books and the imaginary world of dressed animals and knights in armor. He loved reading books about animals that were sort of personified, that would dress up and talk like humans. And of course, you know, a lot of his stories contain a lot of that kind of thing too. And he just fell in love with that. And he was kind of reclusive to begin with, and he had probably a close relationship with his brother Warren. And when Warren left, he kind of delved even more into his books, became a little more reclusive. But he did more than read books. He actually wrote and illustrated his own stories as well, even from an early age. And then another tragedy strikes. His mother's death from cancer in 1908 made him even more withdrawn. His mom's death came just 3 months before Jack's 10th birthday, and the young man was hurt deeply by her passing. So it's a very tragic event that happened for a young boy. And to make matters worse, not only did he lose a mother, his father never fully recovered from her death. You sometimes hear about this, and it's sad when it happens. You know, a parent dies, and the other parent becomes so lost over what happened with their spouse that they can't seem to find it to bring comfort to their kids. And this is what happened with Jack Lewis. Both boys felt estranged from their father, and home life was never warm and satisfying again. So a sad change of events there. The death of Mrs. Lewis convinced young Jack that the God he encountered in the Bible his mother gave him, if not cruel, was at least a vague abstraction. And a lot of people have this reaction when they're faced with tragedy in their life. They blame God. You know, if there is a God, why would he let something like this happen to me? And that was kind of his response. His mom was apparently at least nominally Christian. She gave him a Bible, but he discounted it. And by 1911 or 1912, with the additional influence of a spiritually unorthodox boarding school matron, Lewis rejected Christianity and became an avowed atheist. And from what I understand, this boarding school matron was borderline psychopath. I mean, she was bad news. And it gave him a bad experience in boarding school, which is probably not a pleasant experience to begin with. And she claimed to be a Christian, and he said, you know, enough. I have nothing to do with Christianity from here on out. He swore it off. So the next chapter of his life we could entitle University and Military Service. So in 1916, he was offered a scholarship at the University of College, Oxford, at the University College, Oxford University. And Oxford University was the first place that Lewis felt at home. You know, all these tragic events, I mean, he's kind of a recluse in a book of library, but he went like a duck in water to this college. He just loved the environment. He loved the way it felt. And it really became a part of his life for the rest of his life. It was a major positive influence to him, Oxford University. But that was interrupted very quickly at first because he volunteered to join the British Army in the First World War. He was transferred to Somme Valley, where he took part in trench warfare. And if you know anything about trench warfare, it is brutal, brutal warfare. And again, Lewis gets a dose of evil at its worst. And so, you know, you can see just kind of getting hit after circumstance after circumstance with his mom and then that boarding school. And then now he volunteers, tried to do the right thing, and he ends up in actually being injured. The last months of the war, he was injured by a shell and was sent home to recuperate from his injuries. And during this period of convalescence, he became increasingly friendly with Mrs. Moore, the mother of a close Army friend, Edward Paddy Moore. And he remained very close to Mrs. Moore, often referring to her as his mother until her death in the 1940s. And actually, what the story is that he and Paddy were buddies in the service. And they both promised each other if one or the other of them dies, the other one would take care of what was left of their family. And so Paddy did end up dying. And so he kept his word and he lived with his friend's mother until she died, took care of her. There was some, I guess I should mention, I hate to mention it because I don't like believing stuff like this without better evidence. But there were rumors that he had a relationship with her of some sort, but I don't know that we know that, and I just I only mention that because you may come across that, and I would be careful about believing something about somebody when we don't have certain evidence of it. So anyways, he ends up back at Oxford, completed his degrees, and took up a post teaching at Magdalen College in Oxford from 1925 to 1954 for a good long stint there. He was a prolific writer, and he formed a close relationship with other Oxford fellows such as J.R.R. Tolkien. Well, we know, I guess many of us know the name J.R.R. Tolkien as a writer, Charles Williams, Owen Barfield, and they formed an informal group known as the Inklings. And they would meet at pubs in Oxford where they would read parts of their novels. And he encouraged Tolkien in his epic Lord of the Rings. He said, "Yeah, that's great. Keep writing." And of course, a number of you I know have read. I know my wife read all of our kids that story when they were young. And of course, that's been made into movies by now and all that sort of thing. But C.S. Lewis had a part in encouraging Tolkien. They were good buddies, and they loved to get together and discuss their writings, discuss literature. It was just kind of a little get-together they would have at the pub. And remember, at this point, C.S. Lewis still isn't a Christian. He's an atheist. But now we look at a period in his life we will entitle The Spiritual Awakening. As Lewis continues to read, he especially enjoyed Christian author George MacDonald, one volume, Fantasies, powerfully challenged his atheism. What it actually did to me, Lewis said, was to convert and even baptize my imagination. G.K. Chesterton's book works much the same way, especially The Everlasting Man book, which raised serious questions about the young intellectual's materialism. Now, I got to say, I mean, I don't know a lot about these particular writers, but what I do know about them is they're not really like super solid, sound Christians, if they're even Christians at all. George MacDonald was a fantasy writer. In fact, I think he was the mentor of the person who wrote Alice in Wonderland. So he was into that sort of writing. But he was a universalist and, believed everybody would, ultimately go to heaven. G.K. Chesterton was a Roman Catholic. But again, they are theists, and they're writing in a vein that it's starting to challenge Lewis where he's at. While MacDonald and Chesterton were stirring Lewis's thoughts, close friend Owen Barfield pounced on the logic of Lewis's atheism. Barfield had converted from atheism to theism and then finally Christianity and frequently badgered Lewis about his materialism. So while they were meeting together, some of his buddies that he was meeting with began to strike up some conversations. Why are you an atheist? Why do you believe that? After many evening chats with these and other friends such as J.R.R. Tolkien, who was Roman Catholic, as you might know, Hugo Dyson, Lewis began to realize that most of his friends, like his favorite authors, MacDonald, Chesterton, Johnson, Spencer, Milton, held to this Christianity. So he's grappling with this. He's got his bitterness from his youth, where he rejected God and rejected Christianity. And I think he's the one that I think said that I came to hate the God who didn't exist. Something like that. Which is what atheists do. Anyhow, now he's got all his friends and all his favorite writers are all talking positively about theism and Christianity. And so it begins to have an impact on him. And in 1929, these roads met, and C.S. Lewis surrendered, admitting God was God, and he knelt and prayed. And within 2 years, the reluctant convert also moved from theism to Christianity and joined the Church of England. So he first became a theist, and then finally he became a Christian. And Lewis later wrote, he was a reluctant and unwilling convert, but felt compelled to accept the evidence of faith. People come to faith in all different ways, as you know. Lewis kind of followed a sort of an intellectual trajectory, which you might expect with somebody with his background. And he just felt compelled by the logic of the arguments. And many of his books write in that vein. In his book, Surprised by Joy, he writes that he came to Christianity kicking, struggling, resentful, and darting his eyes in every direction for a chance to escape. He did not want to become a Christian, but he couldn't help it. He was drawn to it. Almost immediately, Lewis set out in a new direction, most demonstrably in his writing. Earlier efforts to become a poet were laid to rest. So, big influence in his life, he begins to move in his writing in a new direction. The new Christian devoted his talent and energy to writing prose that reflected his recently found faith. And I've read a number of his books, I'm sure some of you have as well, and this I have found to be the case, and I'm actually a bit disappointed about it. We could talk about this. In fact, it's one of our discussion questions, so we won't camp on it too long at this point. He concentrated on a more universal form of Christianity, seeking to avoid the sectarianism that was common in his native Northern Ireland. He rarely made any specific reference to a particular denomination of Christianity, but sought to reinforce the underlying Christian values shared by all Christian faith. However, he always remained an Anglican, and to the disappointment of Tolkien, he never converted to Roman Catholicism, which I'm glad he didn't do that. But he writes, I read Mere Christianity. And interesting, I had two experiences reading Mere Christianity, which is one of his more well-known books. My first reading of it was in high school. I had just become a Christian, kind of more on my own. My family was Roman Catholic, and I came to Christ by the grace of God, like all of us do, and I got to a point, because I was really interested in science and things like this, I started struggling with, how does my faith fit with what I think I know about science? How do these things fit together? And how intellectually satisfying is Christianity? I came to Christianity because by faith, by believing in the Bible, but now I'm struggling as a young man. And I had a science teacher who recommended Mere Christianity. He said that he thought it would be helpful to me. And I read it, and I found it very helpful. It gave me a lot of intellectual underpinning to some of the thinking behind Christianity and how it could make sense. And so I had a really positive experience then. Years and years later, my wife and I read through it, and we have morning reading time. And since then, we've become Calvinists. And I had a whole different feel reading Lewis at that point. I found myself being disappointed by him some ways. Like, there was one point in the book where he talks about how, you know, Christianity is like a big hallway, and there are many doors in the hallways, and, you know, there's Roman Catholics, and there's all these, and they're all Christians, you know. And I don't consider Roman Catholics Christians. They don't hold to the gospel, but he did. So that be as it may. We'll, again, discuss that a little bit later. But Lewis's 25 Christian books sold millions of copies, including Screwtape Letters. That's the one where you get a story about the demons trying to take people off track and mess up their lives. Mere Christianity, the one I just mentioned. Chronicles of Narnia, of course, I think most of us are familiar with that. That's the series that was made into a movie. One called The Great Divorce, The Abolition of Man. There were many others. And he got to a point where he began to experience some fame and some fortune in his life, preaching sermons, giving talks, expressing theological views over the radio. He had a radio broadcast throughout the United Kingdom, bolstered Lewis's reputation, and increased his book sales. With these new circumstances came other changes, not the least being a marked upswing in annual income. Throughout the 1920s, Lewis had been getting by on little money. During his student years, his father gave him an allowance, and he supplemented that in what ways he could. But money was always scarce in his youth. So when the young academician took on the responsibility of a family's friend, for example, Patty's mom, finances were always tight, even with the regular tutorial stipend that he was getting. So he was used to living with very little, and he may do, as people will when they find themselves faced with that. But now, with money no longer an issue, Lewis refused to upgrade his standard of living and instead established a charitable fund for his royalty earnings. I found this interesting, and I've heard of others who have done this. I think Billy Graham did this. Billy Graham, when he became famous, if you will, and started getting a lot of income from contributions from his speaking tours and so forth, he would have been able to live a very luxurious lifestyle. He had a lot of money coming in, and he decided that would not be right. He set his income at, it was a fairly generous amount, about $70,000, whatever it was, and he said, no more. After that, all the rest goes to charity. And that's kind of what Lewis did. He said, I've lived on little all this time. There's no reason for me to suddenly become, enjoy the rich lifestyle. I think I'm just going to continue to live a reasonable lifestyle, and I'm going to give all the rest to charity. You got to give the man some credits for that, I think. He supported numerous impoverished families, underwrote education fees for orphans and poor seminarians, and put monies into scores of charities and church ministries. Very generous. During the last decade of his earthly pilgrimage, Lewis's world was invaded by an American woman with her two children In 1952, Joy Davidson Gresham, who became a Christian through reading The Great Divorce and the Screwtape Letters, visited her spiritual mentor in England. Soon thereafter, her husband, she was a married woman at the time, abandoned her for another woman, and she moved to London with her two adolescent boys, David and Douglas. Gresham gradually fell into financial trouble. Her acquaintance with Lewis led to his underwriting the boarding school education of David and Douglas. From charity and a common literary interest that he shared with the lady, grew a deep friendship and eventually love. And they were married in 1956. Joy was 16 years Lewis's junior, but that did not prevent a happy marriage. And here comes tragedy again. A savage case of cancer, however, cut their marriage short less than 4 years after the wedding. I mean, she was way younger than him, and yet she had health problems, cancer. She was so ill even before the wedding that he called it a deathbed marriage. Still, Joy brought Lewis happiness. As he wrote to one friend soon after his marriage, he says, It's funny having at 59 the sort of happiness most men have in their 20s. Thou hast kept the good wine till now. Put poetically, as only Lewis can do, right? A writer in her own right, her influence on what Jack considered his best book, Till We Have Faces, was so profound that he told one close friend she was actually its co-author. Thus, her death in 1960 was like the death of his mother. It dealt him a severe blow. In his book called A Grief Observed, he expressed his grief, anger, and doubts that ensued for the next few years. So again, he's struggling with doubts and grief over just difficult life circumstances. He experienced a lot of that in his life. Lewis died a few years later, 1963, from kidney failure. His death occurred on the same date as the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Wow. I remember that day. I think everybody who was alive on that day remembers it. I didn't remember C.S. Lewis dying. I remember John F. Kennedy dying. Didn't even know C.S. Lewis at that point. Since his death, his books and influence have continued to grow. He's been rated as one of the top English writers of all times, and his books have been translated into numerous languages, as I'm sure will come to no surprise to any of you. So, a very interesting character. Since he's a more contemporary character, we have a few more pictures we can show. So I have a picture of him at age 4. That would have been when he lost his dog and took on the name Jaxie and then eventually Jack. And his favorite childhood books were written by Beatrix Potter, for example, The Tale of Peter Rabbit. I think a lot of us are familiar with that as a children's book, and that was a book. He loved books like that, you know, books of animals that could talk and say interesting things. And I think he also liked books about knights and things like that. He had a lot of interest in different fantasy-type writings. Here we have a picture of him next to his good friend, J.R.R. Tolkien. You can just see them sitting around the pub smoking the pipe, can't you? It's a very interesting relationship there between those two. And there's a picture of his wife that he only had her for 4 years. From what I understand, she was Jewish. And also, from what I understand, her personality might have been a little bit, for some anyway, on the obnoxious side. And a lot of his friends did not care for her at all. And he got into a lot of difficulty over that with his friends. He still loved her. He didn't find her obnoxious, obviously, but some of his friends did. So there you go. C.S. Lewis. Next week, we are going to take a deep dive into Dietrich Bonhoeffer. This is another very interesting, very controversial figure. I'm sure most of you are familiar with him and what happened in World War II with Hitler and all that. So that's a lot of really interesting things that we're going to take a look at on him. So we have some time for class discussion, as we always do, and I'm going to put out a couple of suggested questions we can talk about, but you can always come up with your own. I just do this to kind of get the thing going. So first question is, have you read any of C.S. Lewis's books? I imagine many of you have. If so, are there any that you would care to comment on, positively, negatively, whatever? feel free. We saw that when Lewis went from being poor to being well off due to royalties from his writings and speaking engagements, he refused to upgrade his standard of living and instead established a charitable fund for his royalty earnings. Is this a practice that all Christians who are financially well off should seek to emulate? Just something to think about there. Another question. Lewis in his writings views anyone who holds to broad Christian ideas, which he would basically define as like belief in God, belief in the Trinity, you know, belief that Jesus was God and he came and died and all that. He would view anybody who held to those basic things as a genuine Christian, even if they hold to a wrong understanding of the gospel, such as Roman Catholics. I believe the Roman Catholics do not understand the gospel properly as taught in Scripture. And I do not believe Roman Catholics who hold to a Roman Catholic teaching in that area are genuine Christians. I'm not saying that you can't be Roman Catholic and be Christian. You may be in spite of your Roman Catholicism, but if you hold to Roman Catholic theology, they deny the gospel. Lewis would not have seen it that way. Do you find Lewis's broadly inclusive view of Christianity troubling? And there are a lot of people who take up this mantle today in Lewis's name. In fact, they talk about this kind of the mere Christianity movement. Like, we're getting too picky about Christianity. We need to be more broad-minded about who's a Christian and who's included. And I understand there's a sense in which somebody who calls themselves a Christian, even if they don't understand the gospel the same way we do, we can see them as sort of in that sort of general category. But in terms of being actually having a relationship with Jesus Christ and on their way to heaven, that's another whole other thing. And I would say Galatians 1 would give us a lot of trouble. If it weren't for Galatians 1, maybe we could get by with mere Christianity. But when Paul says, if anyone teaches any other gospel except the one we've given you, let him be damned. How do you get around that? Why would you want to get around that? But there we go. One question I didn't think to include, I came up with it later, which I guess we could throw in the mix, is Lewis is so insightful. I mean, many of the great Christian speakers today, John Piper, the guy in New York,
Keller,
say that, give huge credit to C.S. Lewis for giving them insight into Christianity they didn't have. And yet he has this view that sometimes made me worry whether he was a Christian. I'm not going to go there, but I mean, you know what I'm saying? How could somebody be so brilliant? Should we not listen to those people? Should we not listen to him? He's not a Christian. He doesn't believe. Or should we just recognize that, you know, God brings different people along in different ways? It's a little bit of a discussion we can have about that. So, and again, you can make up your own question if you want. That's just some suggestions from me. So say what y'all would like. We've got plenty of time for discussion this morning. I was worried about having enough time. I was telling my wife, I'm kind of worried, but we're going to run out of time this morning. She says, anytime you worry about having enough time, you always get done ahead of time. I said, well, good. I'm glad I'm worried. I don't always time it as well as I plan. But anyhow. Thoughts on C.S. Lewis?
I've got a favorite quote from him, and I have no idea where I read it or where I heard it, but I guess being a former atheist, he thought through a lot of the implications of being an atheist. And as he, I guess, debated against somebody who was an atheist still, he said something around the lines of, so if you're an atheist and there is no God, and everything in this world is a complete accident, then even the thoughts forming in your brain as you argue against my Christianity is also an accident.
Yep.
Why should I listen to your accidental thoughts and think that you can explain the rest of the world by them?
Yeah.
And that's a great...
It is a good argument.
I have used that argument against 14-year-old atheists in my science classroom.
Nice.
They don't seem to quite... there's no flash of conversion when I say that. But they certainly haven't thought through the real implications of what being an atheist means.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, anybody who holds anything but a Christian worldview has to be grossly inconsistent. And that's one of the ways we can try to raise awareness. Obviously, God does the work. But in terms of our role in encountering and engaging people, try to bring something like that up, because it really does. How can there be any such thing as logic when every thought in your brain is predetermined by a scientific law.
Yeah, or just protons bouncing around in there.
Yeah,
but that doesn't mean there's logic, and it doesn't mean that there's correctness, and it certainly doesn't mean that there's an existence of good and evil.
Yeah, that's the other thing. You know, secular world today is becoming bigger and bigger, as we know, even our society around us. They don't lack for enthusiasm and passion for being against what they consider evil. Why? Who cares? We're just molecules bouncing around. Why does it matter? Why does it matter?
So on the question about Lewis having a broad acceptance of Christian.
Yeah.
I agree with him in this way. So I think everyone in here who's older than, you know, 20 or something, can say that what they thought they knew when they became Christian and what they think they know now are not the same.
Oh, yeah.
In some ways, very major shifts in thinking.
Very much
right?
So.
So should I say, knowing that you, when you were first a Christian, were Arminian and held a lot of these views, should I not have accepted you as a Christian? Should I have said, oh, you're not a real Christian? You don't fully understand the gospel, so you're not a Christian. So that's the kind of danger, I think, in being very limited. I think there's danger in both directions. If you're too accepting, you just like anything goes, well, obviously that's not true.
Right.
But being so, you can get too narrow. Where is that balance? I don't know. I can say where I tend to fall, and it's a case-by-case basis. Not, I can't give you, you know, a broad, this is how you should look at it type of thing.
Yeah.
But I do also think going to looking even at his conversion, using that as a model for people in general, and most, several people in here that I know for a fact, are influenced by people that we might later say, I don't even know that they were Christians,
mm-hmm.
but they were instrumental in my becoming a Christian.
Right.
So that is why I would say, you know, the way God uses these things to bring about his plan, I would rather be on the side that accepts someone who maybe isn't a Christian than reject someone who is, and so find myself in opposition to God because I'm rejecting someone calls us up. So I know that doesn't really narrow that down, but that's kind of how I tend to approach that. And having read quite a number of his books, I love his writing. Do I always agree with it? No, but he has a way to simplify complex ideas and make them understandable. And I think that that's really important, and he does that very well.
Yeah, he's... When he's good, he's very good. And when he's bad, he's horrid. It's like the girl with the curl. Yeah, I mean, I do agree. And I really try to avoid even mentally pronouncing someone a Christian or not. I mean, if they clearly deny the tenets of the faith, yeah. But I mean, if they're in it like a C.S. Lewis, I can be nervous about it. There's a quote in here from Spurgeon. I didn't read it to you this morning, but... It's one that I have to kind of read to myself every now and again. In fact, I had a star by the reading. I didn't see the star. Spurgeon says, you remember the story of the three wonders of heaven. It's on the first one on the second page. The first wonder was we should see so many there we did not expect to see. The second was we should miss so many that we did expect to see there. But the third wonder would be the greatest wonder of all, to see ourselves there. And that's kind of how I look at it, honestly. I mean, I wonder if my own heart is inconsistent in so many ways, honestly. So I don't put myself in a position of Christian, not Christian. You're not, you know. Again, unless they just make it really super obvious. If they're claiming to be a Christian and they express the basic commitment. But there is the concern that Paul puts out there in Galatians 1 is a bit surprisingly stark. He's like, wow, Paul, really? You know, yeah, really. He meant it. So we got to put all these things in the mix when we're thinking about our things. So, yeah, but I appreciate your comments. Other thoughts?
You helped me because I read his autobiography, and it was so dark in his childhood, so dark in his boarding school, that by the time I got to college, I just had to put everything away, and it's like I didn't want to have anything to do with it. It was. He didn't even ever say anything like, now I've changed, or now, you know. It was never, it was just how he was at that moment.
Yeah. Yeah, he grappled with some real doubts and fears and darkness. And, you know, you kind of have to look at the whole picture. And it gives you a little bit of an understanding, maybe an appreciation. You know, we can't excuse things that are bad, of course, but yeah. I would hate to imagine what his boarding school experience was like. It must have been horrid. And I'm sure you can imagine what an environment like that. Any other thoughts?
George MacDonald actually shows up in one of his books.
Oh yeah?
As a character.
Really?
Yeah.
What book is that and what character?
What's the name of the book?
The Great Divorce.
What is it?
The Great Divorce.
Oh, The Great Divorce. Okay, I have not read that one.
The story of The Great Divorce is, Lewis is telling it from his own, but it's a fantasy kind of thing. It's not anything in reality, but he starts out as himself in hell, except nobody knows that. And all of his buddies and friends and everybody there at the bus stop, they're all in hell. But he's getting on the bus to take a little field trip, and it turns out that the field trip is riding up to the very, like, outer limits of heaven, and people from heaven are coming down to the bus stop to give people one final chance to become a believer and step into heaven. So there's this dialogue between people who are already in heaven,
yeah,
trying to convert people. Don't go back on the bus, because if they get, the bus is going back down to hell and never comes back again. So it's their last opportunity. And one of the people there to speak to the disembodied spirits from hell is George MacDonald.
Really? Interesting.
Yeah. Okay. The great thing, this is one of my favorite books. And the great thing about that book, what's going on is he is showing evangelism happening and the way people are still fully resisting the good news. And he's showing just how, and we make application of that by saying, okay, well, yes, that we, this is how bad we are. One of them, one of the disembodied spirits, is a mother, and she's coming up to heaven, and she is demanding that her son, who's in heaven, be given back to her, so she can take him back to hell. And that's just,
yeah,
that's what she would rather. And as a tremendous sinner, that's what we would all rather, if God isn't saved.
Yeah, that ties in a lot to his theology, that we send ourselves to hell, that God's trying to pull us and all this sort of thing.
Oh, I hope I didn't paint that picture. That's not the picture I'm trying to take.
Yeah, he does that to illustrate the sins that keep us from God. That's what the book is about.
Yeah,
it's not
there you
about,
go.
He doesn't believe all of that. It's just a vehicle for his message.
But I think he did have beliefs along that line from what I've read of him. But sometimes he gets in that area and I'm kind of like, I don't know. I even like his book, was it In the Line of Witch and the Wardrobe? It's not The Line of Witch and the Wardrobe. What's the last one where they're going to
last
heaven?
Last Battle.
Yeah.
The Last Battle.
I have a hard time connecting to some of his views of heaven myself. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I got it wrong. But what I do really, that's The Last Battle? Okay, well, the beginning of The Last Battle where you get the ape and the... that's like today. In fact, I read that and I just get the chills. It's like, oh my goodness.
Yeah.
He saw this. You know? Yeah, that's what I'm saying. He has amazing insights at times, and he really, and I love his stuff. I mean, you know, my wife and I sat and listened to that series on a big long trip we took one time. We had the audio books and listened to pretty much the whole thing, I think. And enjoyed every one of the stories.
My favorite of those is the third book, The Dawn Treader.
Oh, really?
It has one of the best opening lines. It says, there once was a boy named Eustace Clarence Shrub, and he almost deserved it. You can see some, the Clive, you know,
yeah.
He hated his name, and this boy had a terrible name, too.
That's probably where that came from, if you think about it. I didn't know that about him at the time I heard that story, so it didn't stick with me like it did you, but yeah. Yeah, and great variety in those stories. I mean, they're one so different from the other. It's not like all the same, you know. I mean, you have the four kids. And the four kids were modeled after some kids that came to stay with him, I think, for a while during World War II.
Oh.
They were like refugee children or something like that. So he had these four kids that came to the house, and he watched their interaction and their conversation. And so the two boys and two girls in his stories were modeled after those kids.
Huh.
That was another interesting thing I came across. There's so many things that it was hard for me to figure out what to put in, what to leave out. And his, I mean, I could sit here and talk about him for 2 days, really. He's a very colorful character. Other thoughts? Anybody?
I think it was helpful with somebody like Lewis and these other Christian intellectuals, Tolkien and others, for us to be open to accepting these insights, drawing from them, without then thinking that we have to accept their theology whole cloth and say, okay, well, we're just going to take that on because, or even say that it's okay.
Yeah.
I mean, perhaps most problematic of everything that as far as Lewis's theology, even is understanding of the atonement. When you reject penal substitutionary atonement, there's some gospel issues there.
Yes.
And so setting that aside and saying, okay, look, when he's not talking about this, it can still be useful.
Yes.
But just kind of keep that in the back of your mind.
Yeah,
as you're reading.
Yeah, I agree. We've been doing a whole series on church history, and I've had to do that with everybody in church history because everybody is going to have, you know, I think one expression I've heard is, you know, swallow the fruit and spit out the seed. And I think that's good advice we can learn from almost anybody if we're willing to just listen. People are given insights sometimes that are far beyond some of their other views and things we may need to learn.
So, yeah, there's another name that popped up, G.K.
Chesterton.
There you go. And I've read a little bit of Doug Wilson, and Wilson quotes that guy all the time.
Yeah, he does.
But G.K.
Yeah.
has said some pretty nasty things about atonement, the way
he did. Oh yeah, he did. He hated it.
And Calvinists in particular.
Against
Calvinism. Yeah, that's you're right.
That's so he's one that I'm going. Well, maybe.
I know, right? I mean, it's yeah.
But Orthodoxy is fantastic.
Okay, I bought it and I read part of it, but I hadn't gotten through it.
Yeah, I understand. Okay. The same way with I've never read Mercury.
Now, is that the one that starts with where he acts like he's discovered Europe or something like that?
It's been a long time.
It's been a long time.
I'm the same way that you were saying. I've never been able to make it through Mere Christianity because I read the introduction and I set it down every time I picked it up because just kind of this broad ecumenism that everything's in. I'm like, I really struggle to get through.
But you get further into some of the apologetic arguments and things like that, and he makes them in just a simple, straightforward way. It's like, you know. So I mean, it's a mix of things. It really is. Well, I appreciate y'all's interaction on that. Very interesting character. I look forward to next week looking at Bonhoeffer. That'll be another whole kind of a deal there, and we'll have lots of interesting discussion there as well. Father, thank you for this time. Thank you that you. You put within each of your children those things which you would have them to be and do and gift them in certain ways. And help us to have the wisdom to be discerning as we listen to others. Help us not to be judgmental in bad ways where we end up rejecting things that we should be listening to. And help us have humility and recognize that we ourselves have many areas, even still, that we don't yet know about, that you will be correcting us on in the day of judgment. And help us to have a humility as a result of that, to be accepting and willing to listen to others while still being discerning. We pray these things in Christ's name. Amen. You're dismissed.